Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Billy Meyer Contact Notes, the audio version, that is. I'd like to start off and introduce myself. My name is Randolph Winters. I'll be your narrator. And before we get started, I'd like to, of course, thank you and your interest in the Billy Meyer material. But before we get started, let me give you a little idea about who Billy Meyer is and why there is this tape set and what you can expect to listen to. To begin with, for those of you that are not entirely familiar with who Billy Meyer is, I should explain just a little bit about him and why it's important that you really would like to listen to this. Billy Meyer, his real name is Edward Albert Meyer. We've all heard many times from people who have claimed to have extraterrestrial contacts over the last few years, and sometimes people say it comes to them in dreams, sometimes they see things in the sky, and some people have claimed to have gone to Venus, other worlds, had contacts and gone on board ships, any variety of things. Beginning in 1975, a Swiss farmer named Edward Albert Meyer claimed to be having contacts with extraterrestrials, human just like us, from his little star cluster known as the Pleiades. What was most unique about these contacts was that he started providing physical evidences much better than anybody had seen before, in the form of pictures, metal samples, biological samples, other witnesses, and these continued on week after week. He started providing hundreds of pictures, and it came to the attention, of course, of UFO investigators all over Europe who flocked to his home to see if this was real, because never before had we seen daytime clear photos like this man was getting, and so, of course, it attracted a lot of attention. Billy's pictures, by the way, his name Billy is a nickname. It comes from his fondness for Old West heroes. He was very fond of Billy the Kid, and that's his nickname, Billy. His real name is Edward Albert Meyer. Well, after from about 75 to 78, he had a lot of contacts. They were almost weekly. These were physical. He took hundreds of pictures, actually 1,400 pictures in all. He took a series of movie film. And these pictures and movie film and the information about his contacts begin to get out into the public. And it attracted, of course, people from all over the planet great interest. And UFO experts like Wendell Stevens and Liam Britt Elders and Tom Welch and Jim Delatosa and other people who were fascinated with the case began to work on the evidence to try to prove its validity. And over the course of years, it was learned that Billy Meyer had taken extensive notes from his many conversations with these beings from other worlds and compiled them into what was called the contact notes. Well, unfortunately, these contact notes were only in German. Billy lives in a little place called Schmidruti, Switzerland, about 45 minutes outside of Zurich. And in that area of Switzerland, they speak German. And he, of course, writes in German. He does speak a little English, but, of course, all of his writings are in German. So he wrote down all the information from all of his contacts, which counted to about 135 of them over a three-year period, where he was allowed to ask questions and receive answers to all sorts of things. So all of this information went into a stack of papers that became called the Semyasi Reports, or sometimes they're called the Contact Notes. They comprise about 1,800 pages. Along with that, Billy has also written numerous books on other related subjects from his own knowledge and his own studies from these contacts. So, unfortunately, that information, unless you read German, and even if you do, it's hard to get the books because you can only buy them from Billy. They're not published and they're not out anywhere. It's very difficult to get a hold of that information. This is what led me to want to go over to Switzerland and find out more myself. I became aware of the contacts back in 1979, and I became attracted through the books, the investigative report by Wendell Stevens and the work of Liam Britt Elders when they put their fine book out. When that came out, I saw the pictures, and something inside of me kind of clicked, and I felt like I just really had to know more about this, and I was very drawn to it. As a matter of fact, you could say I was almost kind of obsessed, I think, for a couple of years. It was on my mind all the time, every day. I was dreaming about it, and I felt so strongly, I was so connected to it, that sometimes I thought I was going a little crazy. I thought perhaps I was, you know, getting too close to it. I was dreaming at night that I was actually seeing Billy have his contacts, and the whole thing became very vivid and very clear to me. So I started writing, and I tried to find a way to get over and meet Billy and find out more about it. For some reason, I felt kind of compelled to go over there. Well, I finally did, and I wound up staying at Billy's house. He invited me to stay there for a while, and I spent a summer with him here at the home, and he opened up his family, his heart, his books, and his information to me, and I had a wonderful experience of learning all about his contacts and getting all of his books and notes, helping him translate part of it in an attempt to get this information out. I returned to California where I live, and I spent some time, actually about 3 years, almost on a nightly basis, giving lectures, talks, and classes about all this information. Since the information in the books and so forth are all in German and they're not published, obviously many people would like to hear about this information and read it if they could, covering the information from his contacts. Now, this is not investigation information. I'm not going to discuss at all any of the investigative work that's been such a fine job done by Wendell Stevens and others. Thank you again for your interest in this, and let's get started. As with anything, when you want to start at the beginning, go back to the beginning. For Billy, this actually began in 1937. He was born 11 o'clock in the morning, February 3rd, 1937. We didn't find out till many years later that he was actually one of four people that were born at the same time, and their births were caused to be born at that time by these visitors, by the Pleiadians. It wasn't until some years later that Billy actually found out about that, but apparently the Pleiadians had caused Billy to be born. They call it procreation, and they somehow manipulated and procreated, as they call it. Just talking about the beam ships and the comfortable shape of the flying saucer that that they were using. Later on in 1981, Billy's going to take some pictures of another ship that's an experimental craft that looks quite different, and over the years has proved to be uncomfortable to people. It's been challenged more than any other picture, so perhaps they were right. A couple of the things I might want to mention about the beam ship that came up here was this, what they call the safety or security thing, that again they reiterated, and maybe they're dropping some clues here, that the light emitting device that they use for the slower drives is used within a range of 153 million kilometers of a solar system. They were commenting that this was important because they had already learned that if they try to accelerate into these, with these tachyon drives or these faster than light travel propulsion systems, if they're closer to a solar system than 153 million kilometers, that quite often it can disturb the orbit of the solar system. Quite often it can throw comets out of their orbit or cause, you know, asteroids and things to go a different direction. So it can be a destabilizing factor to the natural orbit of, you know, bodies moving in a solar system. So they've learned to never accelerate or make these hyperspace jumps closer than 153 million kilometers to a solar system. It took her 7 hours to get to the Pleiades where she lived because it takes them over 3 hours to fly out of our solar system at the slower speeds. And once they get past this security area, they call this 153 million kilometers, they then accelerate the ship. The energy screens around the ship protect it from the mass speed correlation so it's not crushed. Once the ship attains speeds at the speed of light or beyond at some point, the tremendous pressures of the mass speed correlation of space pressing in on the ship are used to facilitate some sort of compression method where the ship is actually converted to another form. She says it's something like a thought form into particles that exist beyond the speed of light. These particles are then programmed for the destination that they need to go. They then reappear at that destination. Say, for instance, they're going to the Pleiades. They go to the Pleiadian area. The ship then is transferred back into its material form, and then it slows down and flies for 3 hours into the Pleiades. The actual time that the jump or the in null time, I says, is just a part second. That actually there is some time transpires, but it's very short indeed. So for the most part, the entire 7 hours is spent speeding up out of the solar system and slowing down flying into the other solar system. Now, many occasions, Semyasi had to come all the way from the Pleiades, but as the contacts continued, on many occasions, she stayed on Earth for quite a period of time, living at one of their underground facilities in the Switzerland area. They had one there, one in Russia, and they did build one in the southwestern part of the United States. And on some times, she would stay on board some of their very large ships, which they call Great Spacers. We call them motherships sometimes. But on some occasions, she did have to fly all the way from the Pleiades, and she regarded that as a very long trip. That's something very different for us, to take 7 hours to go 450 light years and think of that as a long trip. I suppose that's like if you got in your car in Los Angeles and drove to Colorado Springs or Chicago or something, you would I think that was a very long, you know, grueling trip, so they probably regard that as much the same. By the way, in your accompanying book that comes with this audio tape set, Exhibit 1, there's a little drawing you can refer to at this point, and it has a little diagram there of the beam ship breaking into hyperspace and flying over to the planet Eris. So you might want to refer to that. On the fifth contact, which was Sunday, February 16th, 1975, just one day later, there was another contact. And in this particular contact, it was brought out, something kind of interesting here. Billy's writing a book, and at this point, they don't tell us what the book is about in the notes. He's writing a book about something, and they're very excited to see that he's writing the book because it contains some truthful knowledge that's been transmitted to him from some higher life form which they've arranged, and they're very excited to see this information get out into the public area. They are, it says in the notes, a little concerned because they think Billy's too anxious to publish it and it's coming out too soon, but they remark that they're going to leave that up to him, that it's his decision on what he does with the information from the contacts. So it's almost as if they're just kind of like, you know, regarding this a little bit as a test, that they would feed him information, teach him things, and he's going to do books and lectures, and they're going to prompt him to go out into public, but these decisions are really up to him all the way through. It was on this contact that Semyonov began to explain to Billy a little bit about our own history. It seems that in our own education, or these things that they wanted to make clear to the planet Earth, they wanted us to start understanding about our origin, where we came from, and how we really fit into the family of man, and I suppose most importantly that we're not alone, that we really do have some ancestry. The story I'm about to tell you, which is the beginning of the history that they related to Billy several times, gives us some real insight to where we came from, or of course where many of us on this planet come from, and about the terrible history that has gone before us and that we're possibly about to repeat. So let me tell you just a little bit about what happened on that contact. To begin with, one of the first things historically they mentioned, because Billy had asked about it, was the Great Flood. Now, in our current history, our current Christian historians date the Great Flood at 10,079 years back from that date. All the dates they gave Billy were from the day that they were talking. And so since he was talking in 1975, they placed it at that number of years. But they cited that that was not the exact number of years. And that at that time, though, they didn't tell him how far back it really was. They just mentioned that in many cases, some of our history is far off. And I believe that the Great Flood is off about 1,000 years, but it isn't until later on in the contact notes where they explain it again, and we'll go back over it at that point. One of the interesting parts about the Great Flood was what caused it. The Pleiadians are telling us that there exists something they call a destroyer comet, a very large comet that passes through our system. And back at that time period, the Earth had a rotation, not a 24 hours, but something greater than 40 hours. And we rotated in a little differently. The sun did not come up on the east as it does today. So the Earth was a little different than we realize it right now. And that the comet itself had passed by Earth and caused the Great Flood. So at that time, there was great destruction. As a matter of fact, this comet's going to come again in the year 2275. They say this great destroyer comet that caused the Great Flood comes by roughly every 575 and a half years. And it came by in 1680, 295 years ago. So we're going to get it back in the year 2275. It's going to come around one more time. It was the cause of the Great Flood when it came by. And that's what happened then. There was large amounts of water flooded over many mountainous areas, and then it changed. On two other occasions, the comet has come by, and that's what's caused the major change in our planet, why we do no longer have a day that's more than 40 hours. The planet has been slowed down to 24-hour day revolution, and that's because of that comet, and it's even changed the position of the planet so the sun rises now in the east. 3,453 years back, this destroyer comet came very close to Earth again, but something really kind of fantastic happened. When it came by on that particular occasion, it was pulling in tow with it a very large other planet. Actually, the planet was about the same size as Earth. But most of the debris that the comet would pull would be smaller particles. But it had entrapped some previous time, about 130 years before that, it had entrapped another planet and was pulling it. This is how large this comet is. It's so big it's actually pulling another planet alongside with it. Well, this other planet that's getting pulled along comes very close to Earth because the comet comes very close to Earth. Now, again, this is 3,453 years back. And when it comes by, there's a major loss of life on Earth. The comet comes very close. There's a lot of loss of human life and animal life, major loss. Many of the mountain ranges are shifted. Some of them flatten out. Some of them rise up. In the Mediterranean Sea, the lava walls of the volcano Santorini, the walls were erupted and lava spewed out into the ocean. It tore that up very badly. A large storm, rising almost 2,000 meters, is out over the ocean, tearing the waters up in the ocean. The floodwaters run in over Egypt and almost totally annihilate Egypt, causing a great epidemics there from diseases and so forth. The waters flood into Syria, destroying much of the landscape and the harbor cities there. This planet that's in trail behind the destroyer comet as it comes by the Earth passes within 600,000 kilometers and gets captured by our own sun and thrown into an orbit between Mercury and Earth. And this planet body then becomes what we know as the planet Venus. Now, it's not stated at this point in the contact notes where Venus came from, but later on we discover that Venus actually, 8,000 years back, had been pulled loose from its position as a moon around the planet of Uranus. And on several occasions, its orbit had been again changed by this destroyer comet, and it finally comes to rest in the location where it's at now. So that's how we actually wound up with Venus. Before that, we were the second planet. And when Venus came to rest between us and Mercury, it became the second planet, and now we're the third planet. One other interesting thing that was brought out at that point about the destroyer comet, that it also had some effect on our moon. Actually, it brought us the moon. The moon itself is, this is a strange story, the moon itself is a fragment of a planet that's far older than Earth. It's 4.5 million years older than our own planet. What happened was, in some other remote system, they say, in kind of a remote section of the Milky Way, millions of years ago, there was a very large sun that went nova. And when it did that, it pulled into itself. Just before it pulls in, apparently, they explode out somehow. And it pushed many of the planets and so forth that were in that solar system. It just literally blew them out into space. Some of them were destroyed, and fragments of those went floating into space. And this planet pulled into itself. It collapsed into a dark star. When it did that, when it pulled into itself, by the way, its original size was 11 million kilometers in diameter. And when it collapsed clear down to 4.2 kilometers. Now, that's really dense. It's estimated that one cubic centimeter of that type of planetary body then weighs several thousand tons. Can you imagine that? By the way, one of the fragments, there was a dark star in that solar system, a planet. They call a star anything that has an orbiting body around it. So if it's a planet even like Earth and it has an orbiting planet like we do, like a moon around it, they would call that a system. It would be a sun system. And they call a star most any kind of planet. So it doesn't have to be even a gaseous body. There was a dark star in that solar system that blew out. In other words, a planet that supported no life. It was like a dead planet. That planet was torn loose when that large sun went nova, and it was thrown out into space. It was considered kind of a fragment. It traveled for millions of years and finally floated into another system. When it did that, being very large and being moving very, very quickly from that explosion, when it moved into that system, it came by the sixth planet of that particular system, which had life on it. There were inhabitants, primitive life on that planet at the time. But it rushed into the system so quickly, and the people or the inhabitants of that planet were not that developed, they were not able to leave their planet and get away, that The destroyer comet came so close to their planet that it caused their planet to spin, change rotation, and actually go the other direction. There was large floods, and there was so much major loss of life on the planet. Almost two-thirds of the life on that planet was destroyed immediately when the destroyer comet came by it. The destroyer comet then moved by the fifth planet of that system, but it didn't come very close to it, and there really wasn't much damage. It then headed straight into the solar system and was headed straight at the fourth planet of that solar system. As it got close to the fourth planet was so much smaller than this large destroyer comet that's racing into the system. Okay? You see, this dark star is becoming this destroyer comet. It races in headlong right into the small fourth planet, but just before it hits it, the fourth planet explodes and it blows it into all sorts of small pieces which blow out into space. This dark star, which is now becoming a comet because it's pulling all this debris behind it, will later be called the destroyer comet by the Pleiadians. Anyway, it races on its own path, and fragments of this fourth planet that it has destroyed are blown out into space. Well, fragments of that blow away, and about half of the planet is still intact. Half of that fourth planet is flung out into space, floats for countless millions of years, is bombarded by meteorites and other debris out into space, and slowly starts taking on kind of a round form as it keeps getting hit and goes through other things that it's doing out into space. Eventually, that half of that fourth planet comes into another system and is trapped by the second planet. And the second planet at that time of that new system is our planet, the planet Earth. That existing fragment of that old fourth planet comes into orbit around Earth, is caught by our gravitational pull, is pulled into orbit and becomes our moon. So that was the origin of where our moon actually came from. The destroyer comet, which is what this old dark star has become, is still raging throughout the system. It's still raging throughout our end of the galaxy. And again, like I say, it'll be back again in 2275. The thing should be back again. And so hopefully we'll have the technology, whatever. Maybe we could possibly even destroy it. But the Pleiadians remarked that that comet's been around for a long time, millions of years as far as their knowledge, and even actually relates back to some of their ancestors. It's no accident that these visitors from the Pleiades are coming to see Billy. They tell us that we share common ancestry, that back in their history, their ancestors were from a different part of the sky called Lyra. And the history goes something like this, that a long time back, about 22 million years back, the ancient Lyrians had come to Earth on several occasions and colonized here because they were a very high technical race and explored the galaxy many different times. Well, the destroyer comet on one particular occasion had surprised them and come into their system. They lived on three planets at the time. The destroyer comet had raced through their system and destroyed, almost totally destroyed, all the life on their worlds. What had happened was there was a throwback then almost to primitive times. They lost their technology. They were again back into primitive beings and took thousands of years again to develop into a new civilization. After they did develop back into a new civilization, apparently their technologies grew and developed very strongly. They then moved out into space, and they became a rather conquering race. They would take their great spacers, move in around a small planet, and with their great destructive radiation beams, they would just pulverize the planet and take it over. Well, apparently they did this thousands of times, seeding planets all over this end of the Milky Way. Now, these are our ancestors. What happened was that after they had continued doing this for thousands of years, their society grew to great power, great strength, dominating thousands of planets. Their leaders were very, very developed people who learned the ways of the spirit, the power of mind, to be able to link your mind up and use the powers of creation, spiritual powers. What they did, by the way, these great leaders, they were the kings of wisdom, was the phrase. It was they had developed to a point where they had knowledge, such great knowledge of wisdom. They had a word for it in old Lyra, and it's called Iwe, or Yahweh sometimes it's pronounced. I'm not sure exactly how the Lyrians pronounced it, but it's spelled I-H-W-H, and it means king of wisdom. And to the Lyrian people, it was referred to as God. And on the earth, that's what the earth people called it. A king of wisdom was a god. Okay? And that's where that actually started from, those old Lyrian leaders. Well, what happened was, about 230,000 years back, the ancient Lyrians were going through a period of almost 500 years of continuous war, where the people were battling out all the time for their freedom because of the great cruelty of all of these, you know, leaders, these kings of wisdoms that dominated their worlds and controlled everything. So what happened was, during one of their very violent wars, one of the leaders named Aesil decided to split with a lot of their people. What happened was, Aesil leaves, he takes 183 of their great spacer vehicles, these very large craft, and there's 250 smaller explorer ships and about 360,000 people. They leave Lyra during the war and go off into space looking for their own place to settle. Well, what happens is they do. They travel for some period of time out in space trying to find some place to land and put all these people. They find this small planet and they land there and they start building their colony again. Eventually, they populate a couple more planets in that system, and they're living on three planets now in that system. What happens is, eventually, their civilization is growing to new heights again, and they begin exploring other worlds. They detect, by the way, Aesil has a daughter named Plegia, P-L-E-J-A, and after Aesil had passed on, she became the leader of their society, and hence the name we're calling it the Pleiades. It's a hand-me-down in folklore from that name. But her name was Plea. Plea orders the ships to go out and start exploring again because their society now is rising up to great strength and it's time to go out and, you know, look for new adventure. So she sends the ships out. The ships come in contact again with the destroyer comet, see it, and in the debris of the destroyer comet, find some remnants of one of their old home planets, Lyra, and they're following it. And what happens, but they come into the system where Earth is, and they discover Earth. Now, these people had never lived on Earth, but they found that some of their ancestors had. They found traces of old Lyrians who had lived here a long time before. Earth became like a new colony for them, for these people. We're 230,000 years back, approximately. Well, they colonized Earth on several occasions, but unfortunately the colonizations did not work out. Almost in every case, wars broke out among the different leaders on Earth, where they would be fighting, and so they would come from the home planets to calm it down and stop the wars, or in some cases they would just take everybody off of Earth. There was a long period of time for several thousand years when Earth was considered something like a prison colony. They would deport people from the Pleiades and send them here as kind of like an outpost or something when they would be stuck here with no technology. Well, on one particular occasion, a very large culture was built up here. There was a raging war going on in the Pleiades. It's about 50,000 years back from now. 70,000 people flee the Pleiades, and they've got a leader named Pelagon, and he's one of these kings of wisdoms, okay? He comes to Earth with all of these people, and a great culture is started here. This culture lasts for almost 10,000 years, and when it does, Pelagon is revered as a god, and this was the beginning, the Pleiadians say, in our own folklore, where the concept of God really kicked in and got started on Earth. That there were developing Earth people here on Earth at the time Pelagon was here. Now, Pelagon was a very developed being, apparently had all sorts of powers. His knowledge of the natural elements of the universe and of nature were well known to him, where things like levitation, telepathy, and so forth were very common. And the then developing Earth human beings, by the way, he was very large, I understand he was 8 to 10 meters tall, so the developing Earth human beings referred to him as the God, and that's how the concept of God got started here on planet Earth from Pelagon's reign. Pelagon lived to be about 4,000 years old. His society lasted for about 5,000 years after his death, and then finally it fell into war, and most of those people left, and Earth was vacant for quite a bit of time after that. So that brings us up to about, 40,000 years back in our history. At this point, Semyasi stops this particular contact, and Billy's just kind of sitting there dazed with all of this. And she remarks to him that there's a lot more to this story, And then she'll continue with the history lesson a little bit farther on, in which she does periodically. Throughout the context, she's always adding on little different elements of our history. But it's interesting to note that we have common ancestry with the Pleiadians. They're from the Lyra section of the sky, and that they were very warlike. It seems like we're following the same patterns of things that we're doing, that they were doing. We're developing up our technology. We fight among ourselves. We never unify. And we use our knowledge against one another instead of for the betterment of mankind. And that the Lyrians and the ancient Pleiadians went through tens of thousands of years of wars and destruction on their own. The Pleiadians now are peaceful. During the reign of Pelagon, when that war finally ended, that was their last war. They seem to have finally come to the realization that wisdom is a better method than fighting and killing. And they have not had a war since then, and the Pleiadians have developed as a very peaceful, happy race since then. Okay, Billy's seventh contact was on February 25th in 75, so he's having several contacts here pretty close together, sometimes within the following day, but so far at least within the week. By the way, he would shoot pictures on some occasions and send the rolls of film into Zurich. And traditionally, he would usually take two or three rolls of film and just get maybe one back. They started disappearing already early on. At this point, though, Billy hadn't really publicized what he was doing, and not a lot of people really knew about it. There was a group of people around him, but he wasn't really opening up his doors to the public yet. Well, anyway, on this seventh contact in February 25th, they were discussing other UFO contactees. Billy was concerned that other people around the world were talking about having contacts with ETs, and he was wondering if this was really so. And he brought up the subject of Uri Geller and wanted to know if he was really a contactee. Apparently, Uri Geller was saying that he was having contacts with extraterrestrials, but Semyonov informed him that no, that he was not having any contacts with extraterrestrials. He had not had any ride in the beam ships, and but the mental abilities of Uri Geller, I says, were in some ways rather authentic, because he did have a certain amount of mental abilities, but the abilities weren't exactly what he thought they were. If you've ever seen a Uri Geller demonstration, he would bend spoons, and that's what he was doing, at least at that time. And he was attributing that to his great mental powers. And Semyonov informed Billy that what Uri Geller was actually doing is that he was somehow connecting with the spirit of the people in the audience. And he was using their spiritual abilities without them even knowing it. So he was somewhat, I guess, like a catalyst or a conductor somehow, that he would cause that to happen. And he wasn't even aware of it himself. There was a list made of different UFO contactees, like George Adamski. They told him that he was a fraud, that he was making it up. There was a few others, too. They mentioned that Daniel Fry was for real, but I don't think I want to go into that any farther here. What's an interesting thing to note that when Billy would ask these questions, she would usually ask him, what do you think? And he would usually comment and state his opinion on it. And it was interesting to note in the notes that they're always flattering him for being right, for being so much more intelligent than they expected. And it was kind of a common thing. You see it going all the way through the notes where he's always getting flattered and kind of getting his ego buttered up, which was, frankly, to me, kind of a surprise that someone that developed would do that. Either they've really been dealing with some very lowly evolved people, or I'm not sure. Anyway, next question was about the different color races here on our planet. And Billy wanted to know, he says, we obviously have five. We have yellow, white, brown, black, and the red race, the Indians. And I wanted to know, you know, if that was common throughout. And she says, yes, it is very common, that depending on the sun system that you live in, that that would determine the color. And throughout the galaxy and all throughout the universe, there were many different colors. There was even a blue skin race that lived here on Earth. And Billy said he was aware of that he had actually seen some of the blue skin race when he was in India. And she was surprised to know that. She didn't know that he was aware of that. It seems that the ancient forefathers of the Pleiadians, who were the Lyrians, they had dominated many different planets, as we heard a little bit about earlier in the history. And they had seeded many worlds all over the our end of the galaxy. And when they do that, depending on which sun system they're in and the size of the planet, these people would grow to a variety of sizes, anywhere from 50 centimeters tall up to sometimes 12 meters tall. 12 meters tall. Some of those apparently had come to Earth from time to time. And 12 meters, my gosh, that's considered a giant. A meter is roughly about 3 feet, so you've got people 30, 35 feet tall here. So if a local Earth human being, if he's 5 foot tall and he suddenly sees someone that's over 30 feet tall, he's going to be impressed. You know, he'll probably get out of the way quite easily too. The ancient Lyrians, when they came here, began experimenting with the local Earth human beings. And this is where a lot of the unusual mixtures and folk stories came from. Actually, this is where actually the monkey came from. The Pleiadians told us that out of the experiments that the Lyrians were doing with Earth human beings, they were mating people with animals and so forth, and that's where the monkey actually came from. The Darwin theory is wrong. We did not evolve from the monkey. It was the other way around. They also created a lot of other mutations that we hear about, like Neanderthals and the Peking human being and so forth, and the beings in Africa. There's the phrase Evas, by the way, means bearer. When the Lyrians were mixing the people with the animals, the old Lyrian word for a person who bears that thing is called an Eva. And that's where that name come when they were creating Adam and Eve. That's where that actually started. When they were mixing people with animals, they came up with the Yeti, or the what we think of as the Bigfoot. And that was a long time back. When they did that, they were violating, of course, certain spiritual and natural laws to do that. And they created these unusual creatures. The word Adam in the old Lyrian language meant an earth human. That was the word they had for us local guys, or the earth human was an Adam. And that's where we got Adam and Eve. That's where it actually started. They created quite a few of these Yeti-type beings, these large experimental beings. One of the interesting things about them is they had a very long lifespan, almost 15,000 years and sometimes. For the most part, though, they were very shy and kind of, not cowardly, but they were just, you know, very afraid of things, and they hid out a lot, and they hid underground, and quite a few of them were killed. Semyasi told Billy that even though they have a long lifespan, there were 7 of them alive as of 1975, but she didn't expect that we would ever find any of them, because for the most part, they hide out quite well, and they stay out of the way. But it was this mixing of animal and human that the Lyrians did that gave us an awful lot of our old folklore and the Greek mythology and so forth. When we hear stories about giants and Goliaths and so forth, quite often that was nothing more than some ancient Lyrians that were quite tall during that time. Billy had a few other questions, and to kind of get on to another subject now, when he started his contacts, Billy was kind of preoccupied. He used to take a tape recorder and try to get sounds of spirits and different things on tape. He was experimenting with that. And he asked Semyasi about this, if there was a spirit's world and if it was possible to do this on tape recording. And she made an attempt, and I'm going to get farther into this on a special set of tapes later in the series. So I'm going to touch a little bit on what she said there. She said that there is no spirit world, as many people think of it, where you just go to another world where there's this material existence. You don't leave this existence and go into some other spirit world. She actually says, what it amounts to is that there are two types of matter in the universe. There is coarse matter, which is the solid matter, and there is fine matter, which is energy. That when a spirit leaves the body, we are body and spirit, and when a spirit leaves the body, it really has two choices that it can do. It can move into another body, which it does sometimes, or the natural thing is for it to move into this fine matter world. In fine matter world is an energy world. It's not a physical world that you go to. Normally, when you go into the other side, into this fine matter world, there are certain periods of actually even go through there before you return back in to a physical body in this coarse matter world. Well, at least it was encouraging to find out that they actually do come back. Apparently, their science has actually kind of figured that out and nailed it down. So there's some hope there. We are going to come back in some way. If death is caused to an individual, like early in their life, they die by accident or they're killed or something like that, quite often the spirit is confused, does not want to go into the fine matter world because it knows it's not its time, it's not ready to go. And so quite often that spirit will just move right into another physical human being. Now this sounds like a really strange thing, but there are more and more people, even in mainstream fundamental psychology, discovering this phenomena that a spirit when it dies, does not want to leave the planet, does not want to leave the physical plane. It moves into another person. That person then is inhabited by two spirits, and obviously there's confusion of spirit. I know there are certain instances where psychiatrists have worked on this, and through hypnosis, Dr. Edith Fiore's work in particular, I've seen her work on people and hypnotize people, and she's related countless stories where this has happened, where she's found more than one spirit in a body, and through hypnosis she's been able to talk to that spirit and convince it that it has died, that it does need to move on to the fine matter world and move on. The spirit does, and when the person comes out of hypnosis, the confusion is gone, and they're once again just a normal person. It's interesting also to think that quite often people who we think are insane or are just nuts might be invaded with more than one spirit. I understand it's possible there could be three spirits in a body at one time. Billy even remarked that in many cases where we think that our people are retarded or nuts or stupid or something, these are just brand new spirits. These are spirits with no accumulated knowledge. So we have a few extra things we need to learn about this spirit thing. By the way, another little aside here, a spirit, as it goes through multiple lives and comes back, Semyasi commented that if you could see the spirit, that the face generally will always look the same. In the beginning development of any species, like in their first few lifetimes, most everyone looks pretty much the same, because apparently they haven't lived enough lifetimes yet to accumulate enough wisdom, and our face does reflect something about our character and the wisdom that we have. So in the beginning stages of life, when you haven't lived too many lifetimes, everybody looks about the same. She said also that it's not a good idea to try to contact this fine matter world, that for the most part, the spirits over there would probably be confused by it anyway. They don't know any more than they did when they were in the physical world. It's not a creative world. For the most part, the fine matter world is just an energy state of cogitation. There is not creative thinking like there is on the physical plane. So they aren't gaining any new knowledge and information on that side. So they're not going to know any more than they did here, so you might as well just ask somebody on the street your questions. Don't expect that making any contact with the fine matter world is going to bring you any profound knowledge, because you're just talking to spirits that have died, and they haven't gained any knowledge since they left. Also, they say it's just unhealthy. It's just not a good thing to even try to contact the fine matter world. And she remarked that most people who think they're doing it are not anyway. That very few people on our planet, there are very few mediums that really had the ability to do that, that most of them really aren't doing it. There are, it is possible though, she said, that there are some spirits worth contacting and there are some things that can be learned. You want to be aware though of people who maybe have been a medium in this life, in the physical life, and when they pass over and they're on the fine matter world, they would still have the tendency and the idea that they still want to be that. And they would still be trying to fool people or trying to convince people that they know what they're talking about, just like they did when they were here. And if they were confused when they were in the physical world, they're still confused when they're over on the spirit side. So it's really not a good idea to even try to contact them. Billy asked again about the tape-recorded voices, that he's experimented with that, and a lot of people have, where you can turn a tape recorder on, and voices will appear on it, seemingly from out of nowhere. Well, she mentioned that sometimes those voices on a recording tape could be caused by cosmic travelers, higher advanced beings who normally use spiritual telepathy and or primary telepathy to communicate with one another or with beings here on the planet. Sometimes those thoughts can show up. But most of the time, the voice comes from the person who's actually running the tape recorder, which is a pretty wild idea, because she mentioned that your thoughts, as you're thinking, can actually turn up on the tape recorder in the form of words. For instance, you may turn on a tape recorder and you're just sitting there, hoping that it's picking up some sort of spirit information or something, and you're thinking about something. And your thoughts, which do not always express themselves exactly in the same words that your mind may do it, could be going right on the tape. This falls in line with some really interesting work that's going on right now on reverse speech technology, where we're finding out that you can tape record someone talking, play it back in reverse, and find that they are actually speaking, their unconscious or their subconscious is actually speaking what they really mean on the tape in reverse. And most of the time it's a little bit different, because we always form ideas and thoughts before we speak. And then when we say something, we, of course, usually tailor it or whatever to kind of fit what's going on or, you know, to express ourselves in a certain way. Whereas our subconscious mind is very honest, and we don't have to worry about our inside thinking because nobody can hear us. So you may walk up to somebody and comment, gee, you look very nice tonight. And actually what you're really thinking is, oh, I can't wait to get away from this person so I can go get a, you know, a soft drink or something or mingle with somebody else at the party. But on the tape, when you play it backwards, what's going to really come across is what was really on your subconscious mind. So this technology, if we experiment with a little bit farther, may be the beginning of some new technology which could really change our entire social system as we know it. Imagine if everybody had to tell the truth. There are occasionally some real spirit voices on tape, just as there are some mediums who can actually contact spirits. So she says it is possible that occasionally you do get real spirit voices on tape, but apparently I guess it would be really hard to tell, you know, which was really which. They can come from the fine matter world, and here's a clue, another clue into the fine matter world. She says they may come from different fine matter worlds or dimensions. So here they're using the word dimensions, and they're insinuating also that there are different types of fine matter existences, as if there are slightly different levels of it. Apparently you go through different stages in the fine matter world of kind of preparation or something going on before you actually return to the physical existence. Billy also asked about ghost music, if it's possible that spirits can transmit music. And she says, no, that's not possible, that it doesn't happen, that that's not what's going on when people actually record and they get music on tape. It is not from the spirit world. The end of that contact, Semyasi, when she said she was leaving, Billy asked her where she was going, if she was returning to the Pleiades and or where she would stay sometimes. And she remarked to him at that time that, no, they had a base beneath the mountains in Switzerland. And on many occasions, she would stay there at that base. And that they had other facilities all over the planet. I know there was one in Russia, and they did talk it later about building one in the southwestern United States. And there was frequently conversations about something going on in the North Atlantic or underneath the ocean. So they probably have a number of places. And she mentioned that they are in areas where they would be almost impossible to ever detect, even with our good instruments. So apparently they're quite well hidden. If they had a base under the North Atlantic Ocean, I would think that would be pretty well hidden. That'd be pretty hard to get to. I don't know how we would ever detect that. It was on this contact that she remarked to Billy that she was getting a new ship. She was going to get a new beam ship. The old ones that used the old wave principle of propulsion were, you know, very reliable, and they used them frequently, but she was getting a new ship. Actually, this new ship that they had had coming in, they were getting four of them. And she remarked to Billy that he'd be able to take some pictures. And in the slideshow, if you've seen my slideshow, I had these pictures where Billy's gone out and taken pictures of the four ships all at one time. And they're pretty remarkable pictures. Other people have gotten pictures of the occasional UFO, but very rare to get four of them in broad daylight. So she got a new ship. And by the way, this new ship was had a little different capabilities than their old one. It had the ability to make a time shift or a time dilation. And with that, she was able to move in time and actually visit different time frames. One other group of information that she gave Billy on this contact before she left is she told him that she had noticed that Billy had a group of friends around him that were all interested in this material, and she'd examined their thoughts and listened to some of their meetings. And she was not impressed, but she felt that they were all on the right track, and they were a very good group of people for Billy to be with. And she suggested that he actually form a group out of these people. And one of the main reasons was that she wanted to give Billy some information that he could get out to the world, to scientists around the world about certain things. And it would be helpful if he had a group of people to help him do this, to get the information together, do the mailing, etc. So she said, you know, for many years, the Pleiadians had been controlling most of the aspects of the planet. Apparently, they're involved in a number of things like, you know, the axis of the planet. They watch the weather. They have some sort of detecting devices all around the planet so they can monitor incoming ships all the time. She says, one of the things that alarmed him is over the past 60 years, they'd noticed a continuous breakdown of our ozone layer. Now, today in 92, we all know that we are having a problem with the ozone. There's arguments over exactly what it is or what's causing it and so forth, but we're aware that something is happening. In 1975, then Billy's being informed that for 60 years, they'd been monitoring the ozone layer. They were watching the rising use of bromine gases that were floating up into the stratosphere and dissolving the ozone stratum. And she remarked to him at that time that there was 6.38% damage at this time, that even that amount of damage would already start having effect on the life, the quality of life of people and animals and nature on the planet. They considered this a dangerous level. This, of course, allows an increase in the ultraviolet radiations of the sun coming through. There would be three different locations, she said, on the planet where, if left unchecked and this continued, that the ozone layer could get so thin it could actually break through and cause a hole in the ozone layer, and ultraviolet radiations could come through and be quite harmful. And one of those areas was over America, one of those areas was over Europe, and one of those areas was over South America. So we're starting to see that already. We've seen the one over the South Pole. She did remark that one of the things that scientists aren't aware of is that these ozone holes can wander, they can move. Now, if she said that in 75, we've been aware of the ozone problem now for a few years on our planet by our own scientists, and we haven't seen the ozone hole move. And if they remark that they do control many aspects of our planet, then it's quite possible they're controlling that ozone hole and trying to keep it down at the South Pole where it's not dangerous for us. So the other thing that really surprised them was they quite often monitor a lot of thoughts of scientists, and they monitor language all the time. They have these little telemeter devices that look like little small discs, and some of them look like round balls. They're all over the planet, and they monitor things all the time. They discovered that certain scientists on the planet, being aware of the bromine problem, how it affects ozone, thinking that they could make some sort of weapon that would cause an ozone hole over a certain country, scientists had designed like a bromide bomb where they could set it off actually in the stratosphere, blow a hole in the ozone hole, causing these, you know, ultraviolet radiation to rush in from the sun. It would then shine down on our enemies and kill them off. And scientists had actually gone so far as designing and building this bomb, and they thought this was just crazy. So this is why they were remarking Billy to get his group together and try to alert some people about this, because if you blow holes in that ozone, she said it can, naturally it would take hundreds of years before that to heal and get rid of those holes. So she suggested that Billy contact a Professor McElroy at Harvard University and let him know what was happening and give him this information, which he did. Billy did send the information to Harvard, but he never heard anything back. So I would imagine if Professor McElroy ever hears this tape or knows about it, he may remember that letter, but he may have thought it a little unusual to get a letter from a farmer in Switzerland about problems in the ozone when it was barely detectable at that time. At that time, several people were coming to see Billy quite frequently, and this was the beginning of the idea of forming the group around Billy, which later became called the FIGU, which is a German acronym for Free Community of Interest in the Border and Spiritual Sciences and UFOlogy. And today we know there's a thriving group of 49 people in it. So that was the beginning of it.